Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the podcast. It is still recap time, and right after I get done with some recapping, I'm going to do some Jeffrey Epstein, hopefully still tonight, and then more recapping, and then recapping July 5th, and Walt Disney. I've got Scooter Braun. I might be doing two episodes a day, three like today, just to get it all out there for you, because I care, and I want you to know that. So I think where we are now is number 25, I hope. Oh, let's see. Oh, wow. Okay, so this one was a long one, and I'm going to, I thought I was going to fill it in, but anyway, this was a great tip. And I enjoy these kind of tips where somebody just, I don't know, upset the other person, and then they just go on a rant, and they just want to let it go and tell all about it. And this was one of those. And I think it was triggered by the fact that I had maybe written something about Vera Wang and somebody who used to work with her or had a one-week encounter with her said, oh, I've got a Vera Wang story. And these are the best. Because they're full of character and just you can sense the life in them. And I really, really like those a lot. Rather than just, oh, I saw somebody doing some coke. Well, you know, where's the life in that? It's kind of like when I, you know, use one of the long blind items and something that's happened to me, I try and put some life in it. I try and kind of give you a sense of what was happening and where I was. And I'm not going to go into, oh, the skies were cloudy and the humidity was a little bit high for that time of year. Not that kind of thing. But just, you know, just, it always feels, sounds, it's just better when it's a personal kind of story or recollection. And everybody knows it. I didn't go back and look with the original comments, how many there were or how many page views or anything like that. But I guarantee you it's way more than just a standard generic kind of thing, because this person lived it. Anyway, in the beginning, I just say that I used their own words and just remove the names. I'm going to try and fit them in to where it is. Yeah, I think I can do it. When this cable network first appeared, it aired a competition show where contestants competed for their own show on the network. And this was called OWN. It's on OWN. It was called Your Own Show, which is kind of catchy if you think about it. Two of the judges were someone who, big back in the day on a cable channel, they used to play music, and the other was Artiva. So you had, these are guest judges. So you had Daisy Fuentes, who was the back in the day MTV person, and the other was the diva, and that's going to be Vera Wang. The subject of the blind, who you might not recognize, but every single one of you knows her name. So Vera, you might not know Vera Wang, what she looks like. Day one, and this is in the words of the tipster. I showed up at her hotel with her styling team after flying them first class from New York City to LA per her demand, because the talent in LA apparently wasn't good enough, only to have her turn the manicurist away because she had gotten her nails done the day before in New York. $5,000 in travel expenses out the window for that one. Then, after refusing to participate in any of the pre-production meetings, she arrived to set and refused to read her script. She demanded the whole thing be rewritten minutes before filming was set to begin. Then, as the contestants entered the set, she stormed off again to scream at me and some producers because she will not, and I quote, be seen in frame with a fucking whale and a fucking, I'm going to say the word, but I don't like to, retard. One of the contestants was rather obese and one had cerebral palsy. She said her brand doesn't sponsor the Special Olympics. Now, Mark Burnett was running production, and the team took swift action to rearrange things so she didn't have to be seen in frame with the offending contestants, and filming continued for the day. Now, on day two, I arrived at her hotel to get her to set, and I immediately noticed that the thousands of absolutely gorgeous orange roses that decorated the lobby the day before were all gone and were replaced with equally beautiful lilies. I made a comment in passing to one of the lobby staff about the change of flowers because it seemed odd that such beautiful and expensive flowers would be replaced so quickly. He let me know that my special guest was displeased with the roses, so they had to replace them. The day continued with incessant complaints and at least three threats to walk off and not come back. That night, after hearing the reports from set, Oprah sent a bouquet of flowers to the Divas Hotel in an effort to smooth things over and ensure filming could wrap the next day. Day three, I again arrived to pick her up in the morning, and the first thing she said to me is, "Tell your boss that the next time she decides to send me flowers as a peace offering, to make sure they're not bullshit Kmart flowers." Oprah fucking Winfrey sent these flowers to her. Now, I didn't see them with my own eyes, but I can rightfully imagine these were not slouchy flowers of the Kmart variety. We did manage to make it through the filming that day. The episode had to be heavily edited to limit her screen time. Everyone lived, but I swear to you, I have never purchased another diva item since, and every time I see anything about her, I feel sick to my stomach remembering what a vile human being she is. The former cable star, on the other hand, was incredibly kind, genuine, sweet, accommodating, and amazing celebrity to work with. She was a true gem and would have been even if the whole diva situation hadn't happened. So, I mean, you can feel that one. It's like the week that I spent with Sean Connery. You can just feel every little last thing and what he was doing to me and what I was trying to do to him and this war, or the weekend I had with Al Pacino where I was his gopher, basically. You can feel it. And it's that kind of thing. It's so authentic and that you just, I don't know. I wish that the whole site was nothing but those. But obviously, you know, people have to be willing to talk about themselves, and that's not always the easiest thing, and I get that. If anybody gets it, I get it. All right, so that was number 25. Number 26. A Golden Globes one. A nice short one. So the babysitter's sister was the latest person that Javier Bardem cheated on with on Penelope Cruz, who was there for television at the Golden Globes last night, and she left him at home. This cheating is serial behavior. And, you know, it's been going on for a while, and I think that, I don't know if it's an open relationship or she just kind of expects it and deals with it. But, you know, if something works for somebody, I'm not going to say anything. I feel like sometimes it makes the other person look really, really bad that, you know, the other person's flaunting things around town, or not necessarily even town, just in their own country. And what does that say? So another one from the Golden Globes. This is number 27. So there's no way that Sacha Baron Cohen should have been allowed in the same room as Brian May. There's still bad blood, and the actor had some choice words about being blown off or something the actor considers worse, and the actor let the musician know it. Just because the studio threw a wad of cash at the organization, referring to the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, which puts on the Golden Globes, doesn't mean the movie's any good. And the movie, of course, is Bohemian Rhapsody. And, you know, I don't know, did I talk about it at the Golden Globes very much? I don't know. But yes, the Hollywood Foreign Press Association is a group of people that can easily be bought, okay? In the sense that you can get a nomination. I am not saying that you are going to win, okay? However, if in this case, where you throw a whole bunch of money at the organization for all kinds of things, and everybody can divvy it up, and everybody gets bonuses, and oh, here's this money for this money, and this money, and this money, and they know it's coming from, then yeah, you know, you could probably influence a winner, but that takes a lot of money. That takes studio money. However, there's all kinds of ways to get nominated. It doesn't take very many to actually get nominated. And it just, you find 20 of these people and you suck up to them and do whatever you have to do, and they spread the word, and the next thing you know, you're nominated. That's why you get such bizarre nominations, at least a handful of them in the Golden Globes. And it's not something that necessarily you should count as a precursor to what's going to happen with the Academy Awards, because it's a totally different mindset when it comes to, they're all foreign press. They're, you know, so they have different tastes and different standards and different things that they like. And sometimes they like quirky, and sometimes they, you know, it's just, they like shows like Breaking Bad and stuff. And they're less likely to like some shows that would win Emmys, you know? So anyway, Sacha Baron Cohen, of course, had his own idea for how to make Bohemian Rhapsody, and involved a lot of gay sex and being brutally honest and about how Freddie Mercury contracted the HIV virus and then died of AIDS. you know, it was going to be brutally honest. And Brian May didn't want any part of that. He didn't want anybody to know that Freddie Mercury even had any kind of encounter with a man. So, which is why you get such vanilla kind of offerings there. And then somebody put them in a room together at the Golden Globes, and that should not have happened. Number 28. Let's see. If I can find this one. Another Golden Globe one. I often debate with myself whether this with Kaylee Cuoco will get another decent acting gig when the show ends. Now, she did sign a deal, so we will see if it works out. It's going to be a decent gig. I just don't know if it'll, you know, take off. Anyway, she got into a screaming match with some woman, and it was about an ex of the actress and some cheating. And I said, why does it matter? The ex being referred to, I think, was the former husband, but it was unclear. But it was a lot of yelling. And, you know, it's, and it was at the Globes. It wasn't at an after party, which makes it, you know, all the more interesting that it occurred. But her ex was just, he just used her and manipulated her. And it was a really bad situation. But, you know, that was a rebound from the Henry Cavill thing, where Henry, that was just a bad match to begin with. Because Henry here, he likes young and he likes threesomes. He likes to watch two women. And he's got some very serious demands on what he wants in his sex life. And Kaylee was a missionary with the lights off. So that did not work at all. Let's see, 29. There is going to come a time in the next few years that this nanny will not be needed any longer. The children the nanny watches are already to the point where they don't need anyone to really be with them. In fact, one is already out of the house, and in 2 or 3 years, the other will follow. The nanny's been around since the birth of the first child. The permanent A-list actor, Michael Douglas, who's the father of the children, is the one who hired the nanny. At the time, she was very young, and Catherine Zeta-Jones really thought the actor would try and hit on the nanny. There were lots of arguments before the actor said they were hiring the nanny, and his mind wouldn't be changed. For the first decade, especially when the actress' mom was going through some issues, she was convinced the actor was going to have an affair with the nanny. He didn't. He has never done one thing out of place or improper with her. What the actress doesn't know, and her actor has no plans to tell her while he's alive, is that the nanny is his daughter. The nanny was the result of an affair the actor had while married to his previous wife. No one but the nanny and the actor know the truth. And now you do too. And the reason that you know the truth is because he has provided for her, and somebody snitched. So that's how that one came out, because that's kind of the ones that, those are the good ones. Those are, hey, this is a good old Hollywood type secret. And you wonder how many secret children Kirk Douglas has. Okay, so this is an old Hollywood one. In fact, I think the next two are. This is number 30, if you're following along at home with your bingo cards. There were a lot of tragedies back in old Hollywood, and many of them happened to the actors and actresses that were trying and mostly failing to transition from silent movies to talkies. You know, I don't think people really understand, you know, you had these silent actresses and actors that were just so popular. Can you imagine being, say, the level of, say, Chris Pratt or something like that, and then literally the next day, you're Lindsay Lohan, you know? It was just that fast, because these people were hired for their looks and their visual acting ability. They didn't actually have to speak and act at the same time. So it was all about looks. And of course, with it's all about looks, then all these people around the country and the world were, you know, enraptured. And then all of a sudden, they're going from these huge stars to nothing, just gone in an instant, just because they couldn't act while they talked or they had some strange accent or something like that. Anyway. One of these actresses is the subject of her blind. She is foreign-born. Now, her name's Marie Prevost. She worked for some of the biggest directors of the time, including one still known today. She was always known as someone who would definitely hit the casting couch to get work, and she got a lot of work. She even worked a lot via the casting couch, even while she was married to, and at that time, an A-list actor. The thing is, though, he didn't know she was doing that, and when he found out, he left her, and then started talking publicly about what she had done. This caused her to start losing out on a bunch of work. Now, the husband was not finished with his revenge, though. he knew she was an alcoholic who was trying to quit. And he would send over producers to her place with booze, knowing she would drink it because she wouldn't say no to them for fear of missing out on a job. Soon, her drinking was so bad she couldn't work at all and spent her life trading sex for booze. She didn't even care about money. It was just a procession of men all day and night. Now the ex, Kenneth Harland, came over one night and got his final revenge by killing her. Her corpse was found several days later, but she was in such bad shape from the abuse her body had taken and what her dog had done to the body that no one even suspected she had been killed, and probably wouldn't have done anything about it anyway. I love old Hollywood. And you know what? It was so easy to get away with stuff. If you were a big enough star, you were getting away with it. Let's see. Number 31. Another old Hollywood. Lost was how she put it. Lost as a person and lost to history. Her career in film no one would ever see again because of a tragedy that cost hundreds, if not thousands, of careers to be lost to history. Lost to the history is one of the creators as part of one of film's greatest trilogies. Her story was set to be told. She wanted it to be told. She wrote a manuscript. Now apparently the manuscript still exists in a library at that Northern California castle. The manuscript was initially discarded as the ravings of someone who had lost her mind. In it, though, she also talks about the early days of Hollywood, and in great detail discusses one of the greatest directors of all time, Cecil B. DeMille. I mean, everyone knows his name. Also, the center of every dispute she had was with him. He stole many of her ideas, but only managed to have to admit it once. After that time, he had her blacklisted, so she wrote down everything he had ever done to anyone. She wrote about the rapes and assaults. She wrote about his drug use and his part in arranging violence and even killings of those he considered rivals. The list of misdeeds is extensive. The original editors thought she was discussing Jesus or God, but she was using it as symbolism in regards to some of the greatest known works of the time. Several people in the last decade have read the manuscript, and it is a masterpiece. The problem is no one knows how to sell it or market it, so it just stays there with all of its glorious gossip waiting to be seen. And it's Valeska Surratt is the woman's name, the actress. And she was in some of the greatest movies. But there was a, you've heard about this fire that took out all of Universal Records and all these things. There was a fire that took out a lot of old film footage, including everything that she was ever in. Just gone. Can you imagine filming hundreds and hundreds of things that's supposed to last a lifetime and now none of them exist? And so she wanted her story told about the greatest trilogy, and I think it was the Ten Commandments. And it was the Cecil B. DeMille, this Bible thing that he had done. And that's what she was writing about. And he had to admit that he had stolen one of her ideas once. And then after that, he says, I'm not going to do it. I'm just going to blacklist her, and then nobody will pay attention to her. But she wrote everything down. And it's an amazing story that needs to be told. Man, I really hope that somebody will... I don't know how you're going to tell it. I don't know if people get into it knowing what it's about. I don't know how long the movie would have to be. Anyway. This is one of my favorites. It's not really old Hollywood, but it combines new and old Hollywood. One day when he was about 30, Michael Nyquist, who was a foreign-born B-plus list, mostly movie actor, learned the truth. He had the double whammy of discovering who his mother was and his grandmother was all in the same day. The actor, who had a franchise that was way better than the U.S. version, the girl, like the girl with the dragon tattoo, etc., inherited a large sum of money that had been in trust for him for quite some time. He met his mother only once. The occasion was the death of his grandmother, the grandmother who had always claimed she never had any children, the grandmother who did provide for her daughter, but only through her will. She wanted no part of her daughter during life because her daughter was conceived with a man who forced himself onto the actress after a date when she turned down his advances. The daughter was raised by relatives of the grandmother, but with little to no financial assistance. The daughter wandered aimlessly through life and gave birth to our actor before giving him up for adoption. The only time our actor ever met his mother was to discuss the death of the grandmother and to talk about the disposition of assets. Through a series of private detectives, the grandmother kept track of the grandson and also helped him in his burgeoning career until she passed. So who is this grandmother? Greta Garbo, who was the epitome of being reclusive. She was also a multiple Oscar winner and was one of the nominee and was one of the most savvy art collectors in the world when she died. And then the mother is Gray Gustafson Reisfeld. It's just a fascinating story to me. And that, you know, you go through life not even knowing, and all of a sudden you meet your mother and your grandmother, find out who they are. And to find out your grandmother's Greta Garbo is pretty damn amazing. Let's see. Number 33. Nothing real scandalous here, but maybe you sleuths will have a bit of fun guessing this one. Let's see. This is a really long one. Okay, this one. Let's see. Okay. Let's go back a little while, shall we? We have a director who I'd consider permanent A-list, and that is Lawrence Kasdan. He's not in, you know, this person, the one that did the writing on this, they used a lot of great little clues, but would probably not be on many people's usual suspects list. He had just released his latest movie. At the time of the movie's release, he had already been around for a long time and directed some much-acclaimed movies that were in the running for the top award. One movie in particular is still a beloved classic, with a terrific ensemble cast, and it essentially put the director on the map, not to mention his involvement in those movies that you all know so well. And then, anyway, our director had fallen off the radar for a number of years, until he jumped at the opportunity to direct this movie, which was based on a book. He still had a bit of clout in the industry, and his production company managed to secure the rights to this novel, and get a pretty big budget from a major studio. Perhaps this could be his comeback into the mainstream after a long absence. Along the way, a permanent A-list writer got involved, William Goldman. And I've lost my place. got involved and partnered with the director to bring the story to the big screen. After watching the movie, it boggles the mind wondering what they actually saw in the material. It was hardly the kind of material that both the director and writer had much, if anything, to do with in the past. All things aside, shooting of the movie got underway, with a number of good actors signing on for roles, probably just to work under the A-list director, with a script written by the A-plus list writer, based on a novel by Stephen King. How could they go wrong? They all did their best with the script and direction they were given, but playing it serious was arguably not the way to go about the material. The director was treating the movie like he would have normally done in the past, and it just didn't weave together this time around. The permanent A-plus list actor, Morgan Freeman, played against type in the movie, and even he couldn't save it or bring it in credibility. But hey, he was still responsible for delivering the best line, so I guess that counts for something. The B-plus list actor, Timothy Olyphant, who was on a recently axed Almost Network show, seemed to recognize the silliness of what they were doing. But he made his scenes count and chewed through the scenery like no tomorrow. His scenes were some of the more intentionally humorous ones, and at least he seemed to enjoy himself filming them. Eventually, the movie was released and quickly became a laughingstock. I doubt that anyone in the audience was prepared for how ludicrous this film would be, and we're talking about Dreamcatcher. It was jaw-dropping how bad it was, considering the caliber of the people involved. You'd be forgiven for not expecting this type of movie to come from the A-list director. Looking at the credits, there's a number of award-winning cast and crew members across the board, and somehow they caught up in the net. It's not like they did a bad job. Far from it. The film is actually pretty well made on a technical level, but the story and plot make no sense whatsoever. For those who have seen the movie, I'm sure they would only remember the one aspect that, when spoken out loud, would either deter people or encourage them to watch it just to see how ridiculous it plays out. And this is coming from a movie that has one ridiculous and awkward scene after another. Suffice to say, the movie was a bomb, and it wasn't hard to see why. It quickly fell into obscurity and was forgotten. The timing of its release was probably not going to do it any favors either, because of the invasion of Iraq. Considering a major world event, this invasion had just taken place that everyone knew was a bad idea, but was powerless to stop from happening. This movie channeled a few things that were going on at the time. Surprisingly, it doesn't appear on many worst of all time lists, which may be a good thing for the multiple A-list talents involved. As for the director, well, he'll probably always be A-list considering his track record and prior achievements. But even he admitted that this film screwed his career a bunch. He had other projects that he wanted to work on, but because this movie was a disaster, he never got the chance to do them. It was another decade before he got a chance to direct again, and he went back to his comfort zone, albeit without any major studio backing this time. That film also bombed, and after that he didn't have anything to go on, at least not until he got another chance to be involved in the movies that made his name. You know, like The Big Chill. Let's see. That was number 33. Let's do 34. Well, here's one I'll be touching on later with the Jeffrey Epstein, so you're going to hear it twice. Okay, sorry. I know they thought they got away with it when they threw that longtime A-list celebrity in his country under the bus after his death, Jimmy Savile, is who I'm talking about, with planned leaks and a parade of victims. They raised a toast with a bottle of wine that cost $25,000 while they watched child porn they had filmed and collected. Most of it they had filmed. One is a foreign-born permanent A-list musician who's briefly touched the third rail of child porn, talking about Pete Townsend, but got away with his lame excuse because of his fame. The other, a foreign-born permanent A-list socialite type, Prince Andrew, who's been in this space before because of his banishment from multiple countries for similar offenses. Not so much child porn. Authorities and law enforcement wouldn't call it that because of the international incident it would create. It is what it is, of course. Tweens and teens being forced into sex acts with the men while they were filmed. The men obscured either with masks or not shown at all. Their voices altered. Our socialite type, Prince Andrew, would buy the tweens and teens while the dead celebrity and the musician used their fame to attract underage groupies, who then would be put through 10 minutes to 10 hours of sex and filming in as many situations as possible, all the while being filmed. Usually with the celebrities is unknown filming. With Prince Andrew, the victims all knew they were being filmed and what would happen if they protested. Now, with some recent court filings, some of Prince Andrew's actions are coming to light, and he'll make sure to take down as many people as possible if needed. He knows because of his stature he is safe. This would not be true for any of the others. And those recent court filings have to do with Jeffrey Epstein. And of course we see, I wrote this in June 14th. And look, 3 weeks later, it's all coming out. So that was 34. Number 35. Okay, this is the Amanda Bynes one. So long. Okay. This is what I've been upset about for the past 6 months. And also, I need to point out that Amanda sent me one thing that I guess I'd done 3 weeks earlier, and then she just was continually angry and decided to send me a much longer one. And the way she sends me messages is that she sends them probably 20 words at a time, sometimes 30 words at a time. And this is 500 words, maybe 600 words. Yeah, I wish she would learn just to send me big, long things. This is what I've been upset about for the past 6 months. This is what really got to me. I've never felt more betrayed by anyone in my entire life, and I will never forgive them, and I will never forgive myself. I'm jumping back into... I'm jumping back into so many things. I don't have a plan, per se, just getting back to what I was doing before I was rudely interrupted. To be honest, I was actually approached first last year to revive all that. I asked them if they could please wait a year until I was out of my conservatorship. They said absolutely, but instead went to Keenan behind my back, and that's what actually put me over the edge. I've never felt more betrayed in my entire life by anyone in the world. That will come out soon, though. Instead, all that approached Keenan and asked him to run the show instead, I had to hear about it in the press. They screwed me out of a $2 million project and lied to me. I'm hoping a movement similar to Free Britney will spark some concern with my situation. I've not received a dime from my parents in 5 months, which is highly illegal because it is court-ordered. My mother tried to fight my early release and tried to fight with my doctors to get my discharge annulled. Most of my income comes from a beautiful house that I purchased in 2011. I just don't have direct access to my own money, and it's starting to take a toll on me again. My mother's getting ready to have my conservatorship extended far beyond 2020, and she's going to use my recent stay at the facility, the main reason for the extension. My mother refuses to give me funds for school or daily necessities, but had no issue buying a new home in Texas with my money. I'm almost finished with school. I'll be officially an FIDM graduate. This is absolutely insane, and something needs to happen. Most things aren't always as they appear. I can't afford any more negative PR, but I have no other choice. It's been extremely hard to move on and move forward with the limited resources that are being made available to me. I cannot even afford the school supplies that I desperately need for my last semester. My mother wants nothing more than to see me fail, and I'm scared that she might succeed permanently. I'm just very upset with what Viacom did to me. I was literally praying for that job with Viacom. I've never prayed so much in my entire life. I just wanted them to wait a year until my conservatorship was over and I was free. And I feel I would have looked my best ever, considering the amount of work I would have put into myself and into my talent and craft, and countless hours in the gym, etc., especially knowing that I could have been the face and name of a show that I helped become a hit success. I literally thought that Viacom would have waited and given me that opportunity. I was skeptical, but they assured me that they would wait, but instead I had to heard about it in the press, like most things. I've never wanted anything more in my life, but hey, time is money, I guess, and they wanted to rush something that should have definitely not been rushed. I'm not even sure if Keenan is aware of what they did to me and what we had planned, but I met with Viacom last year, and there are photos of me leaving one of our meetings with them. This was the actual reason for everything. This was what caused me to just sort of give up and felt that I may have needed professional help. It sounded so ridiculous when people were told that it was the stress from my paper photo shoot. Huh? What stress? I love the paper shoot so much, and it was shot over the summer. I just don't understand. Ta. And I don't know if ta means bye or ta means thanks, Amanda. I didn't figure that one out, so. And then she gives me these over the course of several days, and then I'm supposed to put them together, and I'm very grateful for it. I worry about her. Okay, number 36, so the last one for this installment. It's long been one of the great mysteries of music. The thing is, it's about to be solved. There have been a string of fairly popular hits in music over the past decade. Nothing to number one or anything, but nice solid charting songs. They all have one thing in common, a mystery songwriter. He's given credit for the songs, but no one has actually done any digging into who he is. Only his lawyer knows his true identity. The writer is someone who went missing 2 decades ago. He no longer wanted to be on the stage. He couldn't handle the pressure to perform and always come up with the group's lyrics. He was going to end up dead if he continued. So he took a decade off, hidden away from the world. When he felt ready to make music, he had a decade's worth of lyrics and set out trying to sell them and music through an attorney. He loves being able to do what he wants to do with no one knowing who it is. I'm sure his family, though, would love to know he's alive. He's foreign-born, and his group was probably A-minus listed at its peak. And it's Richie Edwards from Manic Street Preachers. And the way this came about to me is there is an author who is writing a book and about another author's book. And apparently, you know, they are the ones who discovered through not actually the lawyer, but somebody who worked previously in the law office that Richie was alive. And they directed them to go look at songs first and notice the thread and then see if they could find anything about it. That songwriter, and there was nothing. There's no history on that songwriter. But it's not a stage name either. It's not a fake name in the sense that but there's checks being issued in that name, but it's just, it kind of just appeared out of nowhere. Just one day 10 years ago, there was this person existed who was writing all these hit songs. So there you go. All right, so that is that part. And there's more coming. I'll talk to you guys soon.